Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Upon Raji's death, Indra begged Raji's sons for the return of the heavenly planet. They did not return it, however, although they agreed to return Indra's shares in ritualistic ceremonies. Purport. Raji conquered the kingdom of heaven, and therefore when Indra, the heavenly king, begged Raji's sons to return it, they refused. Because they had not taken the heavenly kingdom from Indra, but had inherited it from their father, they considered it their paternal property. Why then should they return it to the demigods? End of purport. Srila Prabhupada ki. So there's an interesting storyline here, and this chapter contains very few purports by Srila Prabhupada. So in the Bhagavatam itself, there isn't too much description of this episode with King Indra, Raji, and the big fight. But essentially, it's the principle of the everlasting battle between the demons and the demigods. The divine beings and those who are demoniac. And that's a battle which goes on everywhere, in everyone's own consciousness, in life in general. So in the Vishnu Purana there is a little more detail given of this story. There is there is always tension between those two sides. So, and Raji was a very powerful king of earth. And while Indra and the Daityas were fighting, they asked this question, who is the one that can, become victorious in this? Brihaspati obviously was involved as the guru of Indra. And the answer that was given was, whoever has Raji on their side, whoever Raji takes up arms against, whoever he fights for, that side will be the victor. So they both approached him, the demons approached him, and they said, we would like you to fight on our side, win this battle for us. And Raji said, okay, no problem, but I have one condition. The condition is that if I win, then I will become your leader. I will become your Indra. So I'll fight for you, but then I'll be your head afterwards. And the demons thought about this for a while, and they said, no, thank you. It's not worth giving up our long-term proprietorship just for the sake of one battle. So Indra then approached Raji, and Raji made the same request. He said, I'll definitely fight for you, but on the condition that I take your post, that I become Indra after you have been victorious over the demons. Indra said, well, look, I'm going to lose this anyway, so you may as well become the head. And so he agreed to this proposal. Raji was a fearsome warrior. There was practically no one who could stand in his way. Imagine someone who's so powerful that both the demons, who are very competent themselves, and the demigods, who are also extremely competent. I mean, who can generally defeat Indra, who has the thunderbolt? It's quite inconceivable. Both of them have submitted to Raji in a very humble way, and he's agreed to help them. So obviously, from this we can see what happened, that Raji was victorious. He succeeded. And then Indra saw where this was heading, and he realized, I'm about to lose my position now. So he engaged, as all good leaders do when they're about to lose their position, in diplomacy. So Indra, he bowed down before Raji. He touched his feet. He said, oh great warrior, please accept me as your son. You are undoubtedly the head of all of us, and please treat me as your son. And this was done in a public arena. So Raji obviously was very much flattered by this. Obviously he could see where this was heading, but still he went along with it. And essentially what happened was that Raji went back to his post. He's the head of the demigods at this point, but he allows Indra to continue as his deputy. Now this part is described in the Vishnu Purana. So in a sense, Indra is still there in his position. He's enjoying as the king of heaven. He's receiving the shares of the sacrifices, which was one of his concerns. If Yajna is stopped for any reason in the middle planets, etc., then the demigods, they start to feel a lack of annadbhavanti bhutani. They start to feel a lack of nourishment in the higher planets. So that's when they tend to get upset. And this is why Lord Vishnu has created this entire system whereby cooperation between men and demigods, all the systems can remain in peace. So Indra had his shares of the ritualistic ceremonies, and Raji was back in his place. So as a deputy king, he continued. Now there was one problem. It's that Indra hadn't officially been made Indra again by Raji. So naturally, when Raji passed away, his sons decided to take up his father's inheritance. So they invaded the heavenly planets and took over the whole kingdom, being very powerful. And they said, this is our right. So this is exactly the story that's being described today. Prabhupada says, because they had not taken the heavenly kingdom from Indra, but had inherited it from their father, they considered it their paternal property. Why then should they return it to the demigods? So this just gives us another illustration of the constant struggle there is, all based upon sense gratification. During this story, I don't know how much further it goes. Essentially, in the next verse 14, in the next verse, it describes exactly what happened. In that Raji, in that Indra approached Brihaspati to try to rectify this situation. Very little detail is given in this next verse, so I'll leave it. But essentially they approached Brihaspati, who is the spiritual master essentially of Indra and the demigods, and they asked him, look, what can be done here? The sons have taken over something. I need my position back. We need our shares of the sacrifices. What can be done? So Brihaspati made some arrangement by which he conducted a yajna. He conducted a different sacrifice. One, for the promotion of the demigods, and secondly, for the debilitation of the demons. As they currently stood, the demons were very difficult to conquer. They were very strong, very powerful, and they could not be defeated. So what Brihaspati did, he arranged for there to be some discrepancy. And it is said in one place he preached the philosophy of Charvak, eat, enjoy and be merry, to these demons. And obviously he conducted a sacrifice, a yajna, for the promotion of Indra and for his welfare. So as a result of this, based upon this ensuing discrepancy, the demons became very weak, and Indra was able to conquer that kingdom and get back his own place. So this all seems like a very much a standard battle, standard series of battles, standard series of conquests and defeats that you'd find in history books throughout the world. And definitely one aspect of the Bhagavatam is that it does bring out these interesting and colourful events that have taken place throughout Vedic history, throughout Vedic times. Some of these stories are very ancient. Some of them are slightly less ancient, from thousands to hundreds of thousands of years old. But there is always some deep lesson that comes from this. The way that the demons were defeated was that they were misled through a process of sense gratification. And that weakened them. So now sense gratification is a somewhat of an intangible thing. Generally, when we come to Krishna consciousness, we even wonder what the words mean. Sense gratification. And we think, okay, I have senses, I have ears, eyes, nose, mouth, so somehow I'm gratifying them. Well, it's a very brief way to describe something a little deeper. According to the Vedic description, the word sense, the English translation sense, is only approximate in one sense, or you could say incomplete. Vedically, the word sense refers to the sense-acquiring organs and also the acting organs. So the knowledge acquiring senses and the active senses. There are two divisions of them. So whereas we would refer to legs, arms, etc., as organs, limbs, Vedically they're still grouped together with the information acquiring senses. So you end up with these 10 senses, Gyanendriyas and Karmendriyas. And Vedic literature spends a lot of time discussing how these senses can help and how they can hinder us in our progress in spiritual life. In the Gita there is a hierarchy given. Indriyani paranyahur indriyabhya param paramana manasastu parabuddhir yobuddhe paratastu saha. So we understand where they fit. We have the senses, the limbs, knowledge acquiring senses. You have the mind. Higher than the mind is the intelligence. Higher than the intelligence is the soul. So that's not where it starts and ends. The senses are one aspect, and higher than them is the mind. So this concept is raised again and again in the Vedic scriptures because it is crucial. Right from chapter 2 in the Gita, there is a whole description given how sense enjoyment, sense gratification leads to downfall. Dhyayato vishayan pumsam sangasteshu pajayate sangat sanjayate kama kamat krodha vijayate krodha bhavati samoha samoha smritir vibrama smritir bramshad buddhinasho buddhinasha pranashati. By contemplating the objects of the senses, one develops attachment to them. From such attachment, what happens from attachment? Lust develops. From lust, anger arises. Especially when lust is unfulfilled, a lot of anger arises. From anger, bewilderment of memory. When memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost, buddhinasha. And when intelligence is lost, one falls down again into the material pool, pranashyati. So that's it. Pretty much devotional life is finished. We have, through this process of becoming overly attached to supplying some form of gratification to the senses, it is not, when we read this, we don't think we just supply some gratification to the tongue. That is often stated like that, but obviously there's a whole process involved. Our tongue is one of the components of a whole experience. The tongue obviously is the physical organ that tastes, but then there's a whole mental arrangement also by which those sensory inputs start to get turned into thoughts, desires. And our mind, which is a complex repository of all thoughts, desires, unfulfilled desires, aspirations, that interacts in a very complex way. And every now and then the intelligence is there, trying to enter, trying to guide correctly. If the intelligence doesn't succeed for a prolonged period of time, the intelligence itself can be corrupted. It is described in the Gita that both senses, body and mind, these are the sitting places, and intelligence, these are the sitting places of lust. So it actually affects all our components and makes them totally ineffective. You can think of it somewhat like a computer virus. If it infects some part of a program, some part of a data, that aspect ceases to work correctly. It may work in a slightly different way. So if our intelligence becomes infected in a certain way, it will not relate correctly to the mind. The typical system in materialistic civilization is that the senses demand something in good cooperation with the mind. They demand that I want this, I must have this tasty item. I fancy going there for a retreat. I fancy going on holiday to this location. I would like this person. I would like this amount of wealth. I would like this car. And then almost helplessly, without the intelligence being involved, we then almost bring the intelligence on board to help that desire be fulfilled. And the basis of civilization is that from creating unlimited desires, unlimited ambitions, it then becomes our obligation, almost our obligation to society, to act in ways to fulfill those desires endlessly. And then, of course, that's good for the economy. So that's what is promoted. Sense gratification, get the people spending. But unfortunately, that's not a good way to do things. Because our minds, our senses are attracted to items which are definitely not in our best interests. We all know we have crazy thoughts sometimes. I'll admit sometimes there are crazy thoughts which I would prefer to disregard rather than entertain. Sometimes I mention this example, if you've been climbing somewhere in the cliffs or the mountains, and if you go to somewhere like Cheddar Gorge, for instance, if you stand on the top and look down, it's quite a long way. If you go to Niagara Falls or somewhere. But sometimes this silly thought comes in the mind, should I jump? I don't know, maybe it doesn't happen to you, but or you think, what would happen if I jumped? I'm sure most kids think like that. Would I fly? But that's a thought which you cannot act upon. That thought has to be immediately suppressed, because if you entertain it for a moment longer and the senses are colluded into cooperating with that, there's going to be a problem. So not every single thing that pops into our mind is wholesome or helpful for our life. So actually, according to the Vedic analysis, most of the things that pop into our mind fall into this category. Most of those things that are born of a whimsical desire that actually result in no ultimate goal or no ultimate benefit, they all fall into this category, that they are distractions on a path. Some of the consequences may be less obvious than others. Obviously, if you fall off a cliff, that it's clear what's going to happen. However, if you think something that I'm going to create a career based upon my desire to achieve this ambition, that also has a range of consequences. But they won't manifest immediately. They'll manifest in the form that slowly our consciousness becomes altered. And on the face of it, sense gratification looks like a very innocuous thing. It's just part of life. We have senses we have to enjoy. And yes, Vedically that is true also. But because the general propensity or the general tendency is for people to entertain their senses anyway, they don't need to actually be trained to do that. It's something that happens as soon as we're born. As soon as we have our first tasty item, as soon as we have the toy that we like more than the other toys, as soon as we engage in playing with other children, as we grow up, those objects of sense gratification simply become more and more advanced and elaborate. And then we start playing with companies, we start playing with computers, we start playing with countries, if you happen to be the king. Simply our toys, the objects that we interact with, change. But they still continue as we get older. Now, the problem is that this happens anyway and doesn't require training. So Vedic scriptures often promote the opposite. So King Rishabhdev explains very nicely to his sons, Nunam pramatta kurute vikarma, yad indriya pritaya apranoti, na sadhu manye yata atmanoyam asan apikleshada ashadeha, nunam pramatta kurute vikarma. When a person becomes mad after sense gratification, he commits many abominable acts. He first of all becomes very attached to materialistic consciousness. That develops very strongly. And as a direct consequence, he commits many abominable acts, vikarma. Numam pramatta kurute vikarma, yad indriya pritaya apranoti, in order to satisfy the senses. The living entity does not know that the body that he has acquired is actually coming as a result of sense gratification. Nasadu manye yata atmanoyam asan apikleshada ashadeha. And so he concludes, therefore, that given that the body is the source of so many miseries, I do not think it wise for an intelligent person to engage themselves once again in the activities of sense gratification that will cause them to achieve a material body again and again and again. So it's actually a very logical, very clear set of advice that's given. But as we say, the devil is in the detail. And while sense gratification is a topic that we discuss very casually, very frequently, actually putting it into practice and actually making sense of it is very, very difficult. Because we're conditioned to it since birth. We're conditioned to it, we don't see the negative consequences, and we cannot often make the connection between sense gratification and sinful activities. Lord Rishabhdev is effectively stating that as soon as one engages in sense gratification, one becomes sinful. So people say, What's wrong if I just eat this, if I just do this? What's the harm? What will happen? We have our four regulative principles, and some of those principles are more attractive or more, how can you say, tolerable than others. There are only four: no eating, no meat eating, no intoxication, illicit sex, gambling. And for many devotees, generally, giving up eating meat is quite straightforward. They can very easily see the deadly consequences to another living entity. Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda Ki Jai. But then some of the others take a little while to overcome, because they're not seen as so deadly. What's wrong with a little drink? What can possibly go wrong? It's just a drink. Come on, lighten up, guys. Just be normal. You have a drink, everything's all right in moderation. The problem comes when you have too much. Then intoxication. What happens if I have a little flutter, put a little bet that this football team's going to win? What can possibly go wrong? And illicit sex. What's wrong? It's just enjoyable. It's natural. What's wrong? So it's very difficult for people to directly comprehend the danger, because the danger is not visible. It's not actually visible. The consequences come later, because by engaging in those activities, we systematically destroy the four principles of religion. We directly chip away at the principles of dharma. Society, Prabhupada explains, works, and society can be called civilized society or human society when it is supported by these four principles. What are these four principles? Austerity, tapa, daya, mercy, cleanliness, saucham, and truthfulness, satyam. So these are principles which Prabhupada says actually constitute human society. We haven't really even got into anything spiritually elevated at this point. These are the basic foundational requirements for human society. And you will see, actually, in any culture which is successful by some mechanism or by some measure, some metric, that all these four have been involved. Definitely truthfulness is required. If everyone is confusing others by not saying statements that are true, there's very little basis upon conducting any substantial enterprise. Some level of truth is required. Cleanliness. Well, yes, how much does the government spend on garbage collection every year? It's huge. In some countries, they don't bother, and we see the state of it. I won't mention any names. Mercy. It is a very fundamental aspect of advanced human life that we are merciful to others. We obviously look after ourselves primarily. That's something everyone does, look after their own interests. But then mercy means that we also give charity, or we help those who themselves aren't so fortunate. Directly, it does nothing for us. So directly, nothing happens. Perhaps a little bit of ego satisfaction or ego gratification. That I'm such a nice person. I actually helped this person. I helped this old lady across the street. I did some charity work. I did some welfare work. Directly, it doesn't help us. Of course, in the wider sense of karma, it definitely does, because one who engages in charitable activities, planting wells, etc., a whole range is described in the scriptures, will get a birth in their next life, which is very much more elevated than this life. So mercy is important also. And austerity. Austerity means sacrifice. It means giving up our personal sense gratification for the sake of some wider goal. And that you will find in any culture. Any person who is trying to run a business will be able to tell you what level of austerity is required just to run that business. There are a few people, perhaps, who can just do it naturally, without thinking. But many other successful entrepreneurs will tell you that they have to work day and night. They have to get up very early in the morning. They have to put all their energy, their focus, into what they're doing. And yes, then some of them become millionaires, some become multimillionaires, some have vast empires. If they simply focus on something, believe in it, and restrain themselves from other diversionary activities. So these are four fundamental pillars of society, and any society needs them. So sense gratification directly leads to a destruction of each one of these principles. You can do the matching process. Each one will directly counteract one of those. Perhaps we should, as we brought up the topic, maybe we should just do it. So, meat eating. Which principle does this, or which pillar? Mercy. Yes. You're directly killing someone for the sake of your own satisfaction. No meat eating. Intoxication? Austerity. How many people can meditate properly after a drink? How many people have the desire? How many people are competently able to do things after they've had more than one drink? Austerity requires a serious control of the mind in some cases. How is it possible if you take items that will directly twist your mind into being non-capable of doing things? Intoxication, illicit sex. Cleanliness, yes. Unclean, it causes our mind to become unclean, our consciousness to become unclean. And the final one? Gambling? Truthfulness. Yes. We know the incident in the Mahabharata, the gambling incident. That was the start of a tremendous battle itself. A little harmless dice. Come on, Yudhishthira Maharaj, why don't you just play some dice? Now, Yudhishthira Maharaj couldn't really refuse because he was in that as part of the Kshatriya codes also. Someone challenges you, you can't refuse. But still, an innocent game of dice, where does it lead to? The demands that were then made by the opposing side, the Kauravas, definitely went against some of the principles of truthfulness, some of the principles of dharma itself in terms of what they demanded. So there's something that works its way subtly, and eventually the result is gross. So lust starts off subtle and winds up gross. That's a good way to remember it. So this sense gratification, we're talking about sense gratification because Brihaspati's aim in this was to mislead the demons. And he did this by engaging them in a mental attitude of sense gratification. Now, this principle is also found on a number of occasions in the Bhagavatam. If you remember the story of Diti, Kashyapa and Indra. Now, Indra has popped up again in that incident. The very technique that Indra is using now to defeat the demons, he also used to defeat the demons on a previous occasion. So, on this occasion, Kashyapa had two wives, Aditi and Diti. And Aditi is the mother of all the demigods. And Diti is the mother of the demons. Somehow or other it works like that. So Hiranyaksha, Hiranyakashipu. Now they were both killed by Vishnu. As we know the pastime. They were both killed by Vishnu. And Diti was very much upset. Although her sons were definitely tyrants, still she had natural affection for her sons. So she was very, very upset. And so she served Kashyapa. And they performed a ceremony. He engaged her in a process of devotional service with the Pumsavana ritual. As a result of which, she would get a son that would destroy Indra. If you remember, it was in order to save the demigods from these two demons, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu, that Lord Vishnu himself intervened. So her wish was that I want a son that will kill Indra. And so Kashyapa said, he lamented this. He said, oh my God, what am I getting into here? He's very competent to provide that boon. But he says, Indra is the king of heaven. He's supported by Vishnu. It is not a good idea to make an enemy of such a person. So nevertheless, being obligated to by his wife, he went through the process. And yes, a baby was due to be born that would be competent and qualified and empowered to kill Indra. Now, Indra wasn't going to let this happen, so he was keeping a close eye. And there was one occasion when Diti had been engaged in a series of great austerities, as part of that Punsavana ceremony, she was bathing regularly, fasting, controlling the senses. And so it's described on one occasion, because she was very weak and tired through all these austerities, she neglected to wash her hands and to take a bath at the proper time and just went to sleep in the twilight times. Now, some of these things might be a little strange to us because we're not used to the importance of cleanliness and the importance of washing hands in Vedic culture, washing feet, hands, and sleeping at the correct times. But these were all deficiencies that Diti carried out. Indra saw that as an opportunity. As long as she was very strictly following her process, her yogic practice, and her meditation practice primarily, it's not so much a yogic practice, Indra was not able to do anything. She was strong. As soon as this discrepancy came in, it's described Indra entered the womb, and of course we all know what happened then. Indra has these siddhis, he can become smaller than the smallest. So he entered the womb, he chopped up this fetus into 7 pieces. Now this is not quite normal circumstances. Each one of those 7 pieces started talking to Indra. Indra, what's going on? Why are you hurting us? And so Indra didn't exhibit too much mercy and he chopped them up again, 7 times, into 49. And then they said, come on Indra, stop this. We are your brothers actually. Just see the diplomacy now. So the Maruts, these are the 49 Maruts. And they said to Indra, look, we are your brothers. We are your servants. We are subordinate to you. Why? Why are you killing us? So Indra said, okay, if you're my subordinates, I have nothing more to fear from you. And so he left. So Indra, job complete. Again, this point is being illustrated here, that due to a discrepancy in practice, perhaps based upon sense gratification, generally sense gratification is the prime aim that leads to discrepancy in practice, the desire for sense gratification. When sense gratification is uncontrolled, unregulated, or is allowed to overpower us, it leads to holes in the fabric of our devotional service. And through those holes, all sorts of problems enter. Our anarthas become magnified. Other entities who wish to test us use those weaknesses to test us. We all know that as soon as we declare that we are no longer subscribing to this mode of sense gratification in the world, we know that Maya, with all her different enticements, attracts us or tests us. There's 2 ways to look at it. It's either an attraction or a test. Ultimately, Maya is also a tremendous servant of the Lord. So for a devotee who's very serious, a devotee takes all of those tests and uses them again to advance in Krishna consciousness. For someone who is not so serious, those tests become the cause of that person's gradual decrease. Decrease in spiritual potency and then diminishing. This is such an important principle that comes up again and again. One more example I can mention before we close. It's the pastime of Bali Maharaj and Vamandev. Of course, the demigods were very successful, but demigods are generally in their own places and the Lord prefers that they are running the universal affairs. But on one occasion, they offended Brihaspati, the very same Brihaspati who is now helping Indra. Indra offended Brihaspati by not acknowledging him properly when he arrived. Brihaspati didn't say anything, but that was a serious offense made to a seriously powerful individual. And Brihaspati left, and Indra realized immediately that something wrong is going to happen here. I've offended a very person whose feet I should be worshipping. As a result of that, the demigods became weak. And the demons, who at that time were engaged in very serious worship of their own powerful guru, Shukracharya, they became powerful and competent enough to take over the heavenly planets, which they did relatively easily. So then, of course, the pastime continues. But it's just there to illustrate that in moments of weakness, problems arise. And the system, the technique for overcoming this isn't just excessive rigidity. There's a whole description in the 6th canto about this, where the incident of Ajamila is described. And Parikshit Maharaj explains, he's stating this point. I don't understand about this process of atonement or rigid following. One can engage in very strict practice with strict control of the senses. But then, just like an elephant bathes again, those sense gratification desires will simply arise. So what is the point of this repeated sinning, atoning? And then Maharaj Parikshit, and then Shukadev Goswami proceeds to explain. He says, only one who engages, who actually follows very strict sense control, who actually engages in the practice of celibacy, who engages in a very strong, determined a process of chanting the Lord's holy name. Only they, when they engage in devotional service, can kill all these roots with no propensity for them to revive. Niharam iva bhaskara. There is no chance of them coming up again. So it's a process which cannot simply be done by restraint of the senses. There's lots of verses which will conclude that. Not by brahmachari life, not by strict grihastha life, not by following vanaprastha life perfectly, not by strictly adhering to all the rules and regulations of sannyas, nechejaya, nirvapanad, grihadva, the chandasa, neva, jalagni, surayar, not by immersing yourself in water and performing yogic austerities, not by sitting in the midday sun in summer, surrounding yourself by burning coals, some yogis do, can this process of sense gratification, restraint, ever succeed? Vina mahat seva, vina mahat pada rajobhishekam. His conclusion is that one should serve the lotus feet and smear their serve the lotus feet of the Vaishnavas and smear their dust all over one's body. This, of course, means by their mercy engaging in the very strong, serious process of devotional service. So, devotional service does require a healthy attempt to regulate sense gratification. And I'll just leave you with this one point that Srila Prabhupada makes. He says, we must have sense gratification. The senses need to be satisfied. Senses are just like salt in a preparation. Too much salt is not good. And too little salt is not good either. One needs just the right quantity to make food palatable. So simply, we also need sense gratification to keep the senses in harmony, in check, and subdued, and satisfied, so that they will not unduly agitate. So then, of course, we have the ways we do this. We engage our eyes in seeing the beautiful form of the Lord. We engage our tongue in tasting prasad. We engage our ears in hearing katha about the Lord, the nectarian pastimes. We engage the touch in embracing the bodies of the devotees, touching their lotus feet, etc. Very simple process, very practical process. The principle is that our senses need to be controlled. So I'll stop there. I don't know if there are any questions.